none of this was planned. I didn't mean for any of this to happen. And there wasn't like some goal that I'm trying to achieve.
It's How to Be Amazing. I'm Michael Ian Black. I will forever be fascinated with people who seem like they've got things figured out, because I will forever be one of those people who does not. So there's an analytical part of life that always feels just out of my grasp. And I suspect a lot of people are like me. But then there's some people who seem like they're able to kind of figure things out and then explain them back to you in ways that feel relatable, accessible, hopefully fun. And my guest today has made a career, actually a series of simultaneous careers, managing to do just that. Hank Green first came to prominence along with his brother, the author John Green, as one half of the Vlog Brothers, which began as a series of videos on YouTube and which has since developed into a network of video channels, including the Science Channel SciShow, which explains things, the educational channel Crash Course, which explains things, the philanthropic Project for Awesome, which gives things. He's also one of the founders of VidCon, the largest gathering of video content creators, now entering its ninth year, I believe. And he's now an author. His new novel, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, deals with some big questions, including questions about fame and alienation in more ways than one. And I am very pleased to welcome Hank Green to How to Be Amazing. Hello.
Hello. Okay, well, I feel like I'm done here. That was a lot. And
it was
I don't
a
know
lot.
If I can handle.
It was a lot, and it is a lot. And how do you handle? Because it's, I mean, you're the CEO of a company called Complexly, which I guess is sort of the umbrella company for all of these projects that you manage. So how do you do that?
I'm not very analytical about it. I do what I feel like I need to do at any given moment. Like right before I started this podcast, I was frantically researching octopus gestation.
Oh, you should have just asked me. If you had asked me, I would have could have told you all about it.
Dude,
that's my thing.
It's
octopus gestation.
I'm really glad I'm not an octopus, particularly a female octopus. It looks like a rough sort of last half of life. But I do sort of whatever is most terrifying at any given moment, whatever I feel like I've signed up for and need to get done. I don't like to have outstanding things on my list. And so instead of, you know, trying to prioritize, I just let my fear response tell me which thing to do at any given moment, and it seems to work pretty well. I also have an assistant who helps me a lot.
That's interesting that you say you let your fear guide you to accomplish tasks. How did you learn to trust that fear as opposed to flee from it?
I really don't like experiencing stress. I don't like the feeling of stress. I know a lot of people who are motivated by stress and like try to cultivate it in their lives. My goal is really to eliminate it as much as possible, which I guess like if I was really trying to eliminate it as much as possible, I would pare down the number of things I'm doing. But I can't do that because I have what I think is probably like, I don't know if you'd call it a disorder, but I have a sort of a mental framework problem where when I am questioning my self-worth or having something really negative happening in my life, I sort of fall into like the path downhill for me is to how do I make myself feel valuable by like working with somebody really cool or doing something that will be respected or creating something that might make money, any of those things. That's my sort of defense mechanism. Mm. And so I start things to run away from problems when they are problems I can't solve. But when they're problems I can solve, I feel very, very good at any moment when I am decreasing my stress level, when I'm taking care of something and making it go away. That to me is very rewarding and something that I enjoy doing.
You are a personality type, and I think I share your personality type. And I've never talked to anybody about this subject and has expressed this thing that I also suffer from, which is that feeling of, I think you put it well, like there's a sense of having to validate yourself in some capacity by creating these new projects, knowing full well that those new projects will create the stress, tension, and may actually accentuate the fear that you're already feeling. Mm-hmm. And it can become a kind of negative reinforcement loop. I don't even know I'm just making up that term.
It is actually a positive loop is what positive reinforcement loop is what we're sort of ending up with here, except that the effect isn't positive. Oftentimes right. Positive reinforcement loops are actually really bad things because they get out of hand very fast. There aren't a lot of them in nature. Mostly nature wants to like, once something is happening, it wants to give a signal to have it stop happening once it happens enough. And the things that, like, if having more means having more, then you get out of hand really fast. One of the only examples of that happening in biology and, like, human physiology is childbirth, where your body is like, the more the baby is pushing, the more the baby is pushing. And that's how you get a baby out of you. But, like, that's the only thing it's good for.
Well, that's interesting. So what you're saying is this idea of a positive reinforcement loop is an unnatural natural phenomenon. But when you think of it from a kind of business point of view or from a creative content point of view, it seems like that's exactly what you're trying to do, is create these positive reinforcement loops through your different channels. How does one keep that afloat in from a kind of biological point of view, I guess, if that makes sense? From a
biological mental health point of view, psychological point of view. I don't think that I'm trying to do it. And I think in general, I try to get across the idea to myself that, like, none of this was planned. I didn't mean for any of this to happen. And there wasn't, like, some goal that I'm trying to achieve. I don't really, like, I don't think in terms of goals much. This is just sort of, like, the path that I, like, found easiest to go down. Mm. And that's the one that I, and, like, certainly I have done my best to make good decisions. But I don't think that I'm doing this on purpose, and I think that a lot of times it ends up having negative impacts on my life. I sometimes feel like there is a balance to be found between finding a place where I'm, like, I / anyone isn't, like, too totally stressed out, unhappy, unhealthy with their work, and also, like, the thing that we should talk about, which is that we want to do good work. We want to get a lot done. We want to have a positive impact on the world. We want to provide for our families. And so, like, there has to be a balance between those two things. I think a lot of times people are like, you got to take time for yourself. And it's like, yes, I have to take time for myself, but I also want to build something.
Right.
I also want to make something good.
This is kind of the central theme of the new book, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, where your protagonist, a woman named April May, sort of unwittingly stumbles into, I'm trying not to give much away, but stumbles into a kind of both a mystery and a kind of social media career that in some ways mirrors your own. And what really struck me starting the book was about how that initial video that she ends up sort of almost casually creating becomes this phenomena. And I mean, this is heightened for a book, but you've experienced something similar. What was it like for you to find that with your brother when you guys started in the nascent era of video content creation?
The nascent era. It was
a simpler time.
We didn't even know that it was nascent. We thought it was all done with by the time we started in 2007. there are a lot of parallels, and I definitely thought about my own life a lot when imagining April's, though now, of course, is such a very different time than 2007 was. It was very much like I knew, like, I felt like it was a really big deal, and I was so glad that I got to be a part of it. And I still feel that way. But back then I felt very strongly that this was a very big deal, and that it was going to be the to be able to be a part of something that was very new and that not a lot of people were paying attention to, but I believed, like, deep down in my soul was going to become something very important to culture and to, like, human history even.
Hello, this is Hank Green. Thank you ever so much for your interest in the Project for Awesome. In this video, I will explain to you how you can and should participate in the Project for Awesome. Number one, make a video. about a charity. About a charity that you, theoretically, care about. YouTube is a place for people who make videos, so I probably shouldn't spend too much time telling you how to make videos. But a couple of tips, it always works better if you can see the charity in action. It's good if the charity has affected you in some personal way. And never be afraid to ask people to give themselves, give their time, give their money to a charity. Because that's what charities are, people. Of course.
So to be a part of like the early stages of that felt like what would it be like to be a part of, you know, the first decade of television or radio? At the same time, I was not taking it very seriously in terms of the kind of content we were making. And it was very silly and dumb and fun and weird. And I also really liked that about it. And the audiences weren't so big, so it didn't feel like so much pressure.
You talk about the kind of prescience of knowing that this was going to be a thing. A cultural thing, and the idea of you, I mean, for lack of a better word, YouTubers. Where did that instinct come from? Do you know? Do you know, like, why you felt that so deeply?
Honestly, in terms of, like, the gut level of it, it was almost probably entirely because my big brother thought it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of us who have older siblings, it's like you have this tastemaker in your life. And when you're a kid, like whatever they, this isn't true for everybody, but it definitely was for me. Whatever they think is cool, you don't have to think about that, question it, ever think about it again. It is cool. And even as a 27-year-old man, apparently, I was still having that feeling, and still do to some extent, like when John tells me that a band is cool, they're cool.
Were you always close? Was that an important relationship to you growing up?
No, not really. John went to boarding school when I was like 12. And basically after then, we never lived in the same place for very long together. And so I had this implicit respect that was like pretty external to our day-to-day connection. Like the things that he liked were both the things that were not in the mainstream, but when I consumed them, I was like, yes, this is very good. And it wasn't like, yes, this is very good because John liked it. It was like, John liked it, so I gave it a chance. Mm. And once the chance was given, invariably, the thing was very good, whatever it was, whether it was a stand-up comedian or it was a band or it was a, you know, a new way of communicating on the internet.
And what I like about your story in particular, the two of your story together, is that initial vlogging project was, it seems like it was about creating a way to connect with him and for him to connect with you. Mm-hmm. It has a very personal story to it. Can you describe for people who are new to you what that project was and how it developed?
The idea was that we were mostly talking via like instant messenger back then, and that we would see each other maybe once a year, and that we hadn't known each other even as like semi-adults, not even as a teenager did I know John. And I think a lot of adult siblings don't get a chance to really connect as people outside of that original framework of, you know, childhood. And having that chance, it seemed like something that I definitely wanted to do because I really wanted John to think I was cool. Mm. And I also like, I wanted to make him laugh, and he was already, you know, semi, like he had he had books out and had a bit of an audience already. And I was, you know, happy to interact with this guy who was in my life and was cool and who I wanted to know better. So John and I, basically, we made a video back and forth with each other every day, every weekday for a year, and put those on the internet for people to watch. And so John was part of the audience, like the most important member of the audience, but there were also other people we were creating for.
Was it hard for you to be vulnerable enough as an adult man to say to your older brother, I want to be closer to you? And particularly, you know, a brother that you were not that close with.
Yeah.
Was that a hard thing?
You don't put it in those words, Michael Black. You don't say, John, I want to be close. You say, like, we could make a thing and we could do this project together and it would be fun.
I'm home. Good morning, John. It's January 5th and I'm sitting in my basement back home surrounded by all the things I love. I love orange juice. I love Mental Floss magazine. And Benjamin Franklin. Everything is reversed when I look at it on the computer. I thought he was over here. I love these old collages that were on my wall in college that I still have taped together because I think maybe someday I'm going to put them back up on a wall someday. That's a map of the realm of Narnia.
I think guys are like that. I think we have a really, like, men, not all men are like this, but I think that it is a tendency toward not wanting to do something if there isn't some greater cause. And I know that I have that hang up, and I'm glad that I was given the greater cause to service the real deep human need of connecting with my family.
And you have a master's in environmental studies. What drew you to that field?
My undergrad is in biochemistry, and so when I was headed out to Montana to follow my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, I was sort of thinking I was going to like maybe do molecular biology, and so when I went back to school, I took some graduate classes in both writing and in, like, you know, ecosystem ecology and molecular biology and stuff, and found that what I really loved about science was communicating about it, and that I had a good enough base probably that going more specific wasn't going to help me with that. And so it would be very cool to study environmental studies through the lens of nonfiction writing. And that's what I ended up doing. I kind of felt like that was more like maybe my dream, and realizing that like I had really respected a lot of science journalists, and imagining that I could maybe do something like that was really exciting to me.
This idea of nonfiction science writing and this idea of vlogging with your brother, how long did it take for those two ideas to merge?
about four years maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing to me because it's so, in retrospect, it must seem so obvious to you.
Yeah, maybe.
Hello, I'm Hank. I assume you're here because you're interested in biology. And if you are, that makes sense because, like any good 50 Cent song, biology is just about sex and not dying. Everyone watching this should be interested in sex and not dying, being that you are, I assume, a human being. I'm gonna
be teaching. In the early days of online video, no one was doing like content about stuff. Like there was comedy, so that's kind of like a genre, but there wasn't stuff that, there weren't shows, you know, and so it didn't even occur to us until people started doing show like things that we could say, oh well, we've got our thing over here where we do whatever we want and it's about like our personalities mostly. But then we could also, over here, we could say, hey, this is a show about science, mm-hmm. and we're just going to talk about science. And also, like, there wasn't a lot of money in online video in 2010. Like, it just wasn't a very big deal. So, like, it wasn't like we were going to invest $100,000 into hiring a bunch of people to write science stories for us, because there was no way to make that money back.
Hmm. This is an aspect of you that I think is really interesting for my listeners, because there is a very practical side to you and to what you do. You've talked about your 5% rule. Can you explain what that is?
Are you talking about my 80% rule?
I'm talking about the 5% rule, where you were talking about how you felt free to invest 5% into kind of harebrained scheme.
Yeah. I have multiple different percent rules, it turns out. Yeah. I feel like we don't do enough investing in ourselves. I feel like once we have a little bit of wealth, oftentimes the thing that you do is you say, well, I should put this in the stock market and like try to not worry about it and try to have somebody else handle this because it's weird and I don't want to think I'm doing the wrong thing. But in general, like at any point, it's very valuable to invest in your own skill set. And so being able to like say, okay, well, I'm going to spend $5,000, which is 5% of my net worth, on this dumb idea that nobody else thinks is a good idea. And even if it fails, I will have learned why it failed. I'll probably have learned like maybe how to manage a graphic design person or how to manage a coder and like just like how to do both like freelance as a client, but also as a boss and or as a client or and as a freelancer. So I think that like that helped me a lot to be one, to have enough money to take that kind of risk, but also to do it and let myself learn, because it's the best way to learn, man.
What are some of the 5% things, or let's just say some of the early things that you did, or some of the things that you do now that haven't worked, but they were worth the investment for the reasons that you say?
I can give you three, and I think that I've never talked about any of these three. These are the things that I spent like significant portions of my net worth on that were terrible ideas. Mm-hmm. One was a company that tried to rank web hosting services, and then you would choose your web hosting service through that, and then I would get an affiliate payment. That didn't work. I didn't have enough money to build it, and also I was being too kind of shitty about it. I was trying to basically organize it so that I would get I would recommend the one that paid me the highest affiliate.
Oh yeah,
payment.
That's not good. That's really not good. Yeah, that's not good. I mean, that's how we got the financial crash, which is these rating companies, basically.
Yeah, exactly that. I tried to create a website where people could take surveys and it would store their data inside of it. It was Wait, I don't think that was a terrible idea.
Well, no, but you'd be Cambridge Analytical now, and you'd be facing heavy. I mean, it sounds like the things that were bad ideas, and I'm excited to hear the third, were things that very well could have landed you in jail.
Right, or could have become big deals, you know.
There's a fine line. There's a very fine line.
As many of our social media platforms are discovering today.
Yes.
And then the last one was I literally bought the world's largest dictionary of synonyms for masturbation. And I'm not really sure what I thought was good about that.
How big is that? I mean, this is just a hard cover. This is just a thing that exists.
No,
this
it was a website. It was called worldwidewank.com. And the guy who was running World Wide Wank I didn't think was doing a good job. And I felt like I could take that over and turn it into a business. And that was not true.
What started as a self-described dumb idea when Hank and his brother John Green started sharing videos of themselves back in the early days of YouTube has now grown into a veritable industry that's very much about keeping their millions of followers riveted with videos that help explain atoms to kids, make AP exams interesting and compelling for high schoolers, and has raised millions of dollars for charity by inspiring their nerdy fans to give back. Makes you rethink the idea of being a YouTube star, doesn't it? Coming up, we talk about wrestling with personal issues and how writing his first novel was helpful. And I find myself wading into the murky waters of social media regrets. Yes, friends, I've had a few. When you were young and you were thinking about what you'd like to do with your life, you clearly had an affinity for science. What were you thinking about for your life as a young person, as a teenager in high school?
I was definitely thinking I was going to do science. That was my real goal. I wanted to work on, pharmaceutical stuff. That's what I studied in school. Anything that would help people live healthier, longer lives, I was really into. I had the big sort of teenage boy ego thing was I wanted to be working on something that would dramatically increase the lifespan of humans, which, if you ever spend any time in Silicon Valley now, that everybody there is just very obsessed with that because it turns out they're all rich and they're realizing that they're going to die too. And that's a real bummer for them. And
yeah.
It's almost as if we've been having this conversation since Ponce de Leon and before, but you're going to fucking die. So get used to it. And I grew out of that when I was 24, and I'm like, come on guys, let's wake up and stop talking about immortality at this nice, very nice dinner that we're having. And could we just could we talk about humanity for a second and not for the 45th straight minute continue to talk about how to extend the lifespan of humans? I'm just so fucking over Silicon Valley right now.
Clearly.
But ultimately, I got a lot of feedback even from my professors then that the way that they really thought that the way that I wrote about stuff when I wasn't writing papers was actually really good, and that if like I ever wanted to do that, they would encourage me to look into science communication, which is what I ended up doing, which is really freaking cool.
In the book, April May is confronted with these sort of, they feel like competing desires in a lot of ways. And I feel like you're wrestling with those same issues. Like, how do I do good in the world? My instinct is to do good in the world, but then my own personal ambition and sometimes ego can, mm-hmm. can kind of fuck that up.
Yeah.
How do you wrestle with that issue personally, and how did that wrestling inform April?
I think that I wrestled with that issue by writing a whole book about it, you know.
Right.
And it was so interesting to write this book because it was in a lot of ways like me working through stuff and also like finding stuff out that I didn't know about myself, but about like also about like the nature of celebrity and like where I'm at and how I need to treat the world like and the social internet. It's hard to think critically in a world where everything is 280 characters and 4-minute videos and there isn't time to write 100,000 words on something. Like, I'd never written anything like this scale of length. And being able to like ruminate on April's life and her journey and her adventure really let me understand some stuff I was not understanding.
What is some of that stuff?
The way that I was being drawn into the rift that is being created, and the way that I was allowing and continue to allow social media to be an addiction that controls me and that makes me behave in ways that are destructive to myself and to the world. And like understanding the mechanics of that better by watching April go through that struggle herself and watching her make these mistakes. And also because the book is written as a memoir, watching her reflect on her own mistakes that she made and realize what a dick she was sometimes was really about, like, it was really good. And also it's good for me to allow me to sort of be more forgiving of other people who are making mistakes on the internet.
Have you been forgiving of yourself? I mean, it sounds like you're reflecting on behavior that you may be looking at self-critically and going, oh God, I was kind of a dick here. I may be reading into that, but we've all had those experiences online.
Mm-hmm.
Have
mm-hmm.
you been able to forgive yourself for whatever transgressions you feel like you may have had?
I feel very tempted to turn that question back around on you.
But thankfully, I don't have to answer questions, but I will. I'll answer it first if you want.
Sure.
I undergo a constant examination that requires this kind of self-reflection, and no, I mean, there's times where I'm not very forgiving of myself. I'm not very forgiving of things that I have said or done that have hurt people. But I'm always willing to forgive somebody else, and it's a hard thing to struggle with, because I think it's such a common theme that our own worst enemy is ourselves, or our biggest critic is ourselves, and that is something that I deal with on a near constant basis. And it's not just online. I mean, it manifests itself probably most often there, but in my personal life too, constantly. It's hard.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I kind of structure that is one, I try to be forgiving of myself in the same way I would be of another person, especially my past self.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that by looking at like, what were the causes of that behavior? What was I misunderstanding? And why did I misunderstand it? And I think that like turning compassion onto yourself is a positive. I think it also is part of the mechanism of growth. So yeah, I do forgive myself for some of the mistakes I've made, like straight up, like I didn't know I was hurting someone.
Right.
And, And no one had, like, I was just not exposed to something that it became very clear to me later that, like, a thing that I could have said would have been very destructive to someone else's self-image, or even just, like, sort of wading into a space that I wasn't really welcome in, with my big, you know, social media persona and, like, bringing all of my followers into that space. I think it's very hard to understand. Especially, like, I've watched a lot of young people go from no followers on social media to a year later having, you know, literally millions of followers. And especially when you're, like, 19, 17 years old, it's so hard to know when the transition happens, when you start to, like, have to be really fucking careful. And you could, like, suddenly throw this massive just wave, this tide, this surge of negativity towards someone who thought that they were having just, like, sort of a private chat amongst friends.
Right. Now you are a decade into this, and YouTube's audience when you started was probably roughly in terms of age where they are now. Did those people come with you on this journey over the last 10 years, or is your audience constantly sort of being turned over the way Nickelodeon's audience is, for example?
Yeah, it's definitely a mixture of both of those things. Like, as John and I got older, like, our the kind of content that we got also got older. Like, we aren't making stuff that would appeal to, you know, 17-year-olds in the same way that we once did.
Right.
And so even the new people that are coming in are older than they used to be. So it's not like Nickelodeon where we're sort of making stuff for the same demographic forever. But we also have a lot of people who have stuck with it or who watch occasionally and who used to watch a lot, but now watch like once every month, or they'll catch up after a couple months of not watching or something.
And do you worry about aging out of YouTube?
No. I don't worry about, like, at this point, I don't worry about my audience shrinking anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't really care, which is a really nice place to be, because I have a lot of other ways of connecting with audience. You know, I there is now a diversity of connection points, whether that's Twitter or podcasts or YouTube or, I guess, Instagram, though I'm not a big Instagram user. And then also I have a lot of different connection points on YouTube. Like, I've got SciShow and Crash Course and Vlogbrothers and my personal channel, Hank's channel, which is a much smaller audience, but I really like making content on there because it feels more natural and, like, people don't have as high expectation for the quality of the content.
Hello, it's Hank Green. There's very little time left for me to make this Vita video and get it online. Also, I'm about to run out of batteries on my camera, so I have to do this really fast, and I'm going to tell you the story of how I met my wife, Catherine. People have been asking, and I wanted to do it on a fast day, where the video's not going to be very long, because it's not a very interesting story. Now, a lot of people will meet their significant other, their life partner in a school, which is how I met Catherine. I had a dorm room that was here, and she had a dorm room that was here, and there was like an outside here, so we weren't in the same dorm, but like our rooms were very like physically close together. Like, I slept probably 10 feet away from her my entire freshman year. During the times when I wasn't sleeping, you know, no feet away from her. Ding, 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 ding.
And then you've moved into, obviously now, a much older technology, just print. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you approach this book with the same practical business mentality as you've approached everything else? And
what a great question. It's wonderful. Yeah, I definitely wanted to write a book that would sell well.
I don't understand, like, that mentality at all. Having written several books that have sold terribly.
People have been asking me when I'm going to read the first chapter in a Vlogbrothers video, like John always does. I haven't done that yet because look, I agreed to let a newspaper publish the first chapter in an effort to market the book to people. So I can't. I have to wait for them to do it, and then I can do it. Also, like, come on, John, what an easy video. But now,
every single time I make a YouTube video, almost always, I have a hope that I'm structuring it in a way that it will be shareable and people will want to tell their friends about it and it will reach outside of my core audience. So I think about that with most of the content that I make, even with tweets, and certainly not every tweet, but yeah. So I definitely wanted to write a book that was also one that would be really accessible to people who, I'm a very slow reader. I read a fair number of books, but I take a long time to do it. And it's just like, it's how my brain works. And so like, I wanted to be very sparing with words to tell a lot of story with fewer words, which is also, you know, a lot of how I make video. And I wanted it to be, you know, a compelling plot, adventurous, but also like get across a lot of ideas. And also, like, you know, I felt like it was a good idea for a book because my feeling is that if online content creators, if they really like the book, I think it's going to resonate with them because it's kind of about their life. Yeah. Some they'll want to talk about it and they have an audience. So that, like, even that partially, I was like, ooh, this is good. This makes me want to invest more time in this book because maybe that will be something that gives it a leg up. And so, yeah, I mean, like, I am not saying that I'm like hyper analytical about, like, I'm trying to craft the most saleable product. Like, the number one thing to me is like being faithful to April and her story and also reality if I can, even though it's sort of like a speculative book, doesn't take place in this current reality. I don't know what to say about that. It takes place in the near future.
Sure.
So yes, I did want to make something that was marketable and that would be, you know, really compelling, and people would want to tell their friends about it and share it.
Yeah, I think there can be a kind of, I don't know, snobbery might be the best word, about people who approach art and commerce from a practical point of view, as opposed to those people who think the two must forever be separated. And I really admire people who are able to combine those ideas and make things that they feel are true to them, and they can be passionate about those things and are unabashed about the idea of, and I hope it appeals to a lot of people, and then, you know, the ellipses, and I make a lot of money. There's nothing wrong with that. Well, because that is, yeah, that is how you sort of keep score in the world, and that's how businesses keep score, and that's how that's how you end up with the security that you have.
Right. I mean, what makes an idea seem valuable to you, to each individual person? And for me, like, I do look at economic sustainability. I look at whether it's going to be a thing that's going to be able to generate revenue for me and etc. But I like, there is this thing about keeping score that I have been thinking a whole lot about, that that I would love to get away from, because there are lots of ways to create value without converting that value to dollars, and all dollars are is a way of trading value. So really, dollars are value objectively. Mm-hmm. They are this like value holder. But there's lots of value that cannot be turned into the value holder. But that does not mean that it's not value. And that does not mean that it's not wonderful and beautiful and creating good moments in people's lives and creating a better world. And so I think that, like, we tend to focus on the thing that we can count, even in like education and everything. In video games, we focus on the thing that we can count, and that leaves off a lot of things that we can't count.
Are there parts of your life that get undervalued because of the value that you do place on the kind of commerce side of things?
Yeah. I was once hanging out with my mom. We were walking through Yellowstone National Park, and she said, "Why don't you ever draw anymore?" And I said, "It's just really hard to monetize."
Oh.
And she, like, the face of my mother hearing me say that, where she was just like, "Oh, but what have I created?" But that's not it. Like, it's not that. That's not. It's family. You know, mm-hmm. It's relationship. It's friends, and like creating good, strong relationships where I can be vulnerable and connect with people who I can be honest with, who are not my wife. Would be really great. And to be spending time with my son, and to never ever think, like, to never have that desire to look at my phone or to email somebody about a new series that I want to do. I don't know if it's the dollars attached to that or if it's some other but like it might as well be because it's something. It's some artificial value construction, some like thing I've built in my mind that is telling me that that would be more valuable than watching a baby get have fun in a splash pond, which is the best thing.
But very hard to monetize.
God, thank God.
All right, last thing on How to Be Amazing. Every episode we end with the Amazing Five, in which I will ask for a recommendation in each of five categories. You said your brother John got you into cool bands and music, mm-hmm. so I'll ask for a recommendation in music to begin.
Well, if you want one that John suggested to me, I'm going to say the Mr. T Experience, even though he would want me to say the Mountain Goats.
I remember the Mr. T Experience. Are they still around?
Yeah, they're still touring. They just had an album come out. Yeah, I feel like a year ago. It's like pop punk.
Pop punk. And the Mountain Goats are a little on the softer side of the rock experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I like them both. I mean, why did I just say that? I've never heard the Mr. T Experience. I just always like their name.
Oh, you've never heard the Mr. T Experience?
No, I've never heard
them.
Oh,
you should check them out. You would be super into it.
I bet I would.
Listen to Love Is Dead. That was their big album that would have been a hit if Green Day hadn't happened.
Ah, right. Damn Green Day. Again and again and again, I find myself cursing Green Day. Food.
The Windmill Bakery outside of Missoula, Montana, where they make the best donuts in the world.
What makes them so good?
They weigh about 45 pounds each. I don't know how you can make a donut that big and get it cooked all the way through. It's literally magic.
So it's like wheelbarrow sized?
You should share it with a friend for sure.
Okay.
Like it's a meal.
What is what flavors are they most renowned for?
There is one flavor. There is one flavor.
Oh, there's only
there
one.
There's just glazed donuts, and there are never enough of them, so there's always a line, and they are always hot.
Huh. It's called the Windmill Bakery outside of Missoula?
Yeah.
Sounds great. Movie and or television?
RuPaul's Drag Race.
Really?
I gotta say, I'm at the stage in my life where I don't want to be asked to care a great deal about a TV show.
And so you can invest just enough in the drag race.
Exactly. Yes. And I feel like everybody's going to, in the end, everybody's going to be okay.
Right. Yeah. We're all going to get through this fine.
Somebody might hurt their knee, but nobody's going to get fucking decapitated.
Right. Right. Not yet. Not yet. Book.
Space Opera by Catherine Valenti. It's like, do you like Douglas Adams?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
It's like Douglas Adams, but it deals with like problems that are happening now. Oh. And it is also about a band that has to go compete in the universe's Eurovision. And if they lose, then the Earth gets destroyed. It's amazing.
So it's sort of like the Hunger Games. Like you go, like every planet has to go with their best song. And if they lose, their planet gets destroyed.
Only if it's your first time. If you win the first time, then you just get incorporated into the galaxy and you don't have to worry about getting destroyed again. It's basically the idea is that like music is the one thing that every sentient species in the galaxy does.
Right. And, but if they do it badly, then that off with your species' heads.
Exactly. It's just all over for you. They do it very humanely.
It sounds like that would be also very funny. I mean, you said it's Douglas Adams-esque.
It's hilarious.
Great.
It's so every line is perfect. I love it. I got halfway through the book and I stopped and started over again because I loved it so much.
I've never done that. That's a high recommendation. And then finally, miscellaneous. Anything that you love from your life that you would recommend to others?
Summertime heirloom tomatoes.
Yeah.
Man, like the real stuff that like fresh off the vine, either that or, it's summer in Montana. So I'm feeling the produce, yellow watermelons mm-hmm. just showed up at the farmer's market for the first time. Fresh peaches. God, produce, man.
Produce.
Just generally produce.
How do you consume fresh tomatoes?
My preferred way is probably in a caprese salad.
Uh-huh.
So olive oil, vinegar, balsamic vinegar, basil, mozzarella cheese, yeah, and salt and pepper.
I've become a big fan of just a sliced tomato with a little salt, a little pepper all by itself. If it's a good tomato, to me, there's almost nothing better. That's just tremendous.
It's a shock for me as somebody who didn't like tomatoes because I didn't know what a real tomato was. But yeah, then you have a good one and you're like, oh, I get it.
Hank Green, it was such a pleasure talking to you. And thank you so much for all your educational work with SciShow and Crash Course and for mentoring these young people who are entering this entirely new field. Thank you for being thoughtful. And the new book is an absolutely remarkable thing. It actually is absolutely remarkable. And so, Hank Green, thank you for being amazing.
Oh, thank you.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, why don't you give us a nice review on iTunes? And if you don't like it, how did you make it all the way to the credits? I think you did like it, to be honest. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio in New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Robin Lynn with music composed by Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.